Welcome to Book It,
a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books. Book It is hosted by the Blue Manatee Literacy Project,
a nonprofit that operates an independent bookstore in Cincinnati, Ohio.
When you shop with Blue Manatee, you are giving back to the community. For every book purchased, BMLP donates a book to a child in need.
Book It is hosted by me, Michael Woodson.
And me, Jill Burkett Ragacy. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Jill.
So I was reading a lot recently. Well, a lot's probably an overstatement. I read an article recently about like generational events, because of course at the time we're recording this, we're still sheltering in place during a pandemic.
Yeah.
And it was talking about these once in a lifetime, possibly traumatic events that happen to, it was about any generation, but the article was specifically talking about, I was born in the last year of Generation X. And so it was really looking at the quantity of events, like generational events that have happened to Generation X and millennials, and things like the Challenger explosion and the Great Recession and now the pandemic. And I'm curious, what is the first like big event that you remember?
Yeah, I don't think it'll come as a surprise that my answer is September 11th.
Yeah.
And not only that, but that event was so massive that all we have to say is the date of it, and everyone knows what we're talking about. And I remember very specifically, I was in social studies class. It was third period, and we were doing some sort of group project. It wasn't a project, but it was sort of like in class. We did it with our part, like the person sitting next to us. And my teacher in the teaching aid had left the classroom, and we didn't notice that until they were coming back in. And our teacher came in and just immediately was like, everybody stop, something has happened. And she just turned on the TV, and her tone just made everyone really quiet. And she turned on the news, and the day stopped, and we just watched what was going on. And then later we found out that she had set up that classroom assignment so we would be distracted, because at the same time, all of the teachers went and met in the middle of the classroom or in the middle of the school and decided really quickly, do we show the students what's going on, or do we just move forward with the day? And they really quickly had to decide, like, no, they're going to want to remember that we allowed them this moment. And I really remember all of it. I mean, I remember that day better than I remember, like, moments of, like, my senior year of high school. You know, like, I was 11 when that happened. And I remember then going to my science class, and my science teacher, just every teacher dealing with it in a different way, deciding, do we move forward with the lessons, or do we talk about it? And I remember coming home from school, one of my friend's mom called my house and left a message for my parents and said, like, hey, if they cancel school, can Andy come over? Like, no one's gonna be home, we just don't know what's going on right now. Like, it was one of those things where it's like, we didn't, the impact felt like it was going to happen all over the country, like literally. To the point where, we talked about this a little bit in an earlier episode, but something that really scared me was that the adults had no idea what was going on either. Mm-hmm. And I was coming out of that age where, like, I didn't need a nightlight anymore. And I remember that night being like, can I sleep with the hall light on? Because I'm just, like, really scared right now. And really, like, immediately falling back into, like, a childhood fear. And I think, to your point, though, like, my generation, I think we thought that was going to be it. And then, and then came the war because of it. But then also came the recession. And then now this pandemic. But honestly, I do think that because 9/11 was the first one, it still has a significant amount of weight in my memory and in my life. What about you?
Yeah, I echo a lot of the things that you said about 9/11. I was in grad school when that happened. When I left for class, we thought it was like an accident, you know, when the first plane hit. And it wasn't until I got into class and our professor was late that we found out more about it. And I was much more of a young adult when that happened. As a child, I very much remember the Challenger explosion, which was in 1986. I was in elementary school, and that was the shuttle that the teacher was on. And so we had followed along. There was like a whole, I don't know if it was like a formal curriculum or something that my specific teacher was really into, but we had followed along and we'd talked about the experiments and we'd followed through this like social study type newspaper, like her getting ready. Like it was an event that we were invested in. Yeah. And, the explosion happened during the time of day that we ate lunch. And so we were in the cafeteria and they used to have the big TVs because TVs, you know, used to be so deep and they were on these big square rolly carts.
Yep. Had to check them
out. And so there was, they rolled in. I remember there being like three TVs in the cafeteria and everybody was trying to get all sat down really quickly so that we could be quiet and watch the shuttle take off. And then it exploded.
Wow.
And I remember it being absolutely silent. Like I just remember the absolute silence of it. And it kept playing and nobody knew what to do, I think. And much like you described, I remember looking towards the adults in the room and nobody moving until finally, I think it was one of the cafeteria workers just came over and turned off the television. And then all of a sudden I remember noise.
Wow.
But I remember like up into that moment, like, and they were talking about it and you were seeing pieces fall and it was very clear that something was wrong. Now, of course, we were kids. So in my mind, you know, I don't know, everybody pushed like an ejection seat button or something. Right. Like I didn't in that moment understand that there had been a loss of life or anything like that. And we finished lunch, we went out to recess, and I remember coming back from recess and our teacher talking to us and telling us about what had happened. And it was so clear that she had been crying. Mm. And I don't know, that piece of it, the silence and her with the puffy eyes is the part that's kind of just like burned in my brain. Because like you said, it was like, the concept that your teacher doesn't know what to do or doesn't know the answer was like, what's happening in the world?
The teacher aide also was crying really hard.
Yeah.
And I remember that was like the first sense of reality with it, because to us it was this thing that was happening in another state, but like had no like Ohio or like our reality. We were 10 years old, 11 years old. Like the realities for us were really hard to believe. And I remember the teacher's aide had also clearly been crying. And I overheard the social studies teacher go up to her and ask, like, are you okay? And she was like, yeah, I'm fine. I just need to get hold of them. And then it came out that like her parents lived in New York. And again, like this thing had just happened. We had no idea really what was not yet, we didn't know how widespread the plan had been or anything. So she was just, everyone in New York was like evacuating their homes because they didn't know like how big is this attack. And so she was just really worried for her parents. And then that was the first time I was like, oh, this is affecting everyone.
Yeah.
The adults included.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's you kind of live in kid world until all of a sudden kid world collides with real life, I guess.
Yeah, and like
I don't know.
It's moments like that. I often think about sort of like everything, as in pre-9/11 and post-9/11. Mm-hmm. And even up to like media generally just felt so much more wholesome. And like, I guess like optimistic. It felt really optimistic. And we read, or for book club, one of the books we read was American Gods by Neil Gaiman. And we were reading it. As we were reading it, I was curious about when it had been published. And it was published like right before 9/11. And I don't know why, but I could tell. Like reading it felt really like different than had that book come out after the attacks on 9/11. And that's how I felt about a lot. I feel about a lot of stuff that I've consumed pre and post. But also that might just be growing up, because I was so young when 9/11 happened. But I was going through adolescence. I mean, I was about to become a teenager, and maybe those things were going to happen anyway. But at the time, it really felt like it shifted everything in an emotional, visceral sense.
But yeah, I mean, even in the current pandemic, on the date that we surpassed the number of lives lost to COVID, when we surpassed the number of people who died on 9/11, I remember that being a discussion point. And then from there, you know, I read last week we had surpassed the point of the number of people who died in Vietnam.
Oh, right.
And I didn't remember it until we had talked to Deborah Wiles, who is our interview today. Mm. But I'm curious. I was Googling this while you were talking. I had brought a book home from Winter Institute called We Dream of Space by Aaron and Shraddha Kelly that is set during the Challenger explosion. Well, a few weeks before. And it's a similar thing. These kids are in seventh grade, and they're following along kind of the lead up mm-hmm. to the shuttle launch. And it's interesting how books kind of, and it's good. This book, Aaron's book, is released on, I wasn't sure if it was out yet, so that's what I Googled. It comes out on Tuesday.
Okay.
And I really hope that it does not get lost in this discussion, because it is, it's really good. It follows these three kids who have great names, Cash, Fitch, and Bird.
Mm.
I just loved their names. And they're seventh graders. And the setting just really spoke to me a lot because of it being a generational event for me.
Yeah.
And my kids weren't really aware of it as a thing.
Yeah.
So I thought, I don't know, I just thought that was interesting. How books become so attached to these moments. And then you kind of go back and you see them as a setting or a retelling.
Right.
Does anything like that strike you about a generational,
yeah,
in a generational event way?
But I also think about how it never seems like the right time. People, mm-hmm. right when certain things happen, it's like it is sort of deemed inappropriate or too soon, you know? And
yeah.
I think that can be true. And I think that it really depends on the nature in which the subject matter is being used. And by that, I mean, like, is it exploitative or is it honorable? And I think that, yeah. I'm trying to remember, like, the first book I read that had anything to do with 9/11 was a book called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer. And
yeah.
The main character's father dies in the World Trade Center. And It is the emotional backbone of the story, and it is drives the entire thing, and I think really honorable and not exploitative. And I think that it is kind of I think anything revolving around like a generational traumatic event is going to be controversial. And I think that book was controversial because it used real imagery in the book, and it showed like images of people jumping out of the building. And it was deeply emotional, and I had a hard time reading it, but I remember feeling like it was necessary.
Yeah.
And I also remember maybe like 5 or 6 years after 9/11, the movie World Trade Center came out. Mm-hmm. And it was, again, specifically about the event. And I went and saw it. And I also felt like it was a true story. It was these three firemen who were trapped in the World Trade Centers and survived it. And I think that the concept of like trauma, like how do we get out of this and remotely feel hopeful, to like stories that come out of it that are hopeful, is like the common trajectory of how we deal with traumatic events. Like, because like we're a species who like needs hope. Like we need to pretend right. that everything's going to be fine at the end of the day, always.
Yes.
But I do think that for me, it's like the difference between being honorable and being exploitative.
It's really interesting because it has been such a discussion on literary Twitter over the past 3 weeks.
I'm sure.
It's like, please don't spend this time writing your pandemic novel.
Right.
Like over and over again. That's been kind of interesting. I read that book and I know it was controversial. I did enjoy it. Yeah. I was also thinking about that Adam Sandler movie. Do you remember that movie where I was trying to remember the name of it? But Adam Sandler has lost his family in 9/11, and he ends up befriending his old college friend.
Rain on Me?
Who's played by Don Cheadle.
Yes. I saw this movie in theaters.
Yes.
I forgot that was 9/11 based.
I remember he kept remodeling his kitchen.
Wow. I have completely forgotten about this movie. I think Jamie and I saw it together.
Oh, that's funny. It just popped into my head. I remember seeing it and the time, whenever that time was that it came out. And I don't know that I've thought of it again until we started having this conversation.
But so there's a movie actually called, I think it's called Remember Me. I think it's a Robert Pattinson movie, and it's a teen romance or young adult romance. I don't think they're teenagers in it. And I haven't seen it, but I do know that, spoiler alert, I don't think anyone gives a shit about this movie, but I'm just going to say it anyway. The end, I guess, Robert Pattinson's character, it's revealed, like, he's at a window and that pans out and it's revealed that he's in the World Trade Centers and he dies in the attack. And there's been no mention of, like, that it's 2001, that this has... And people were pissed. They were like, you used this tragedy... You exploited this tragedy. Yes.
Yeah.
And And I remember being like, that is fucked up. One. Two, I remember my friend Jess went to go see it. And she was like in the movie theater bathroom at the end. She was overhearing two girls talk about it. She heard one of them go like, so what was that about? And the other one was like, I don't know. I guess he... died or something. And she realized they don't really know about 9/11. Like there was enough of an age gap between these girls who were at that point maybe 13 or 14 and she was 23 or 24, so they were like roughly 10 years apart. They like the imagery was meant for my generation and up, and then the generation below hers needed more explanation and they didn't get the ending.
That's really interesting.
It is so interesting.
So Michael and I interviewed Deborah Wiles about her upcoming book called Kent State. And of course, as the title implies, it is set in the 4 days, including the day of the Kent State shooting itself. And next week, from when we're recording this, May 4th this year is the 50th anniversary of the incident at Kent State. So the timing is really nice to kind of pause and reflect on that, because of course that's a generational experience for another generation. And I was really blown away by this book.
It's one of those things where I think it was the first YA book I read this year. And so I was really like heavily in adult fiction, and it had been a while since I'd read a YA book, and I have sort of an expectation of what I think I know what I'm going to expect when a book is written for a specific age group. And this truly just like blew me away, and it reminded me to not underestimate what teenagers specifically can handle and like give them a little bit more credit, because it didn't, I mean, it pulled no punches. It's really emotional and honest.
It really is. And I agree with all of that. It is being positioned and marketed as a YA book. And I do think that it works for the YA audience. But I would also say, as an adult reader, I connected with this book in a really deep way. And it is written in verse and from multiple voices. And I had, of course, read books with multiple voices and read verse books. This was the first book I had read that combined the two. And it started the basis of our conversation with each other about this book. It's really well done. It takes a second to kind of get situated in it. I read the first two pages and you think like maybe, okay, it's two people. And then you're like, wait, no, there's four people here. And then you're like, wait, what's happening? Yeah. And then I went back and I reread the first two pages and then I was like, okay, I got it. I know what we're doing. I'm all in and I want to hear what everyone has to say. It is, the source material is great. The book is beautifully written, but also, you may know more the word for this, the design of the book, the way they have carried out the font and the typeface, just adds to the experience in a way that's like really lovely.
Every voice has a different font, it's placed in a different part of the page. It adds to character. I mean, it's like the perfect concept of less is more. Because like, as to her point, there was no gender specific characters. There was no, it was driven specifically by voice. I mean, it's technically all dialogue.
Yes.
And that really helped. I mean, a different font, different placement. I knew.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just like my brain was getting used to it, but once it was in a certain space, my brain immediately told me what voice it was.
It was amazing for me because it felt like being there.
Yeah. Oh. That's a really good way to put it.
You immediately place yourself in the action and you immediately feel the perspective of the speakers.
Well, and to your point about it being just as powerful for adults as it was for, as it could be for teenagers, I think that is to the credit of Deborah Wiles, because she wrote generational characters. It's not just the point of view of a young person. It's the point of view of a young person. It's the point of view of a older couple who lived in the area. The point of view from someone who was, I mean, for all intents and purposes, part of like the bad guys, the enemy, you know, like
the National Guard. Yeah.
And that I think speaks volumes to why I think it's a cross-generational read as well.
I agree. I am very excited for everyone to hear this interview. Yeah. Deborah was so generous with her time and we had a really great conversation. So let's take a listen to that.
So we are here today with Deborah Wiles. Deborah is the author of several highly acclaimed books, including the beloved Love, Ruby Lavender, and two National Book Award finalists, Each Little Bird That Sings and Revolution. Her newest book is the young adult novel Kent State, which chronicles the events of the Kent State shooting in 1970. We are wildly excited to be sitting here with Deborah today. Thank you so much for sitting down with us. If you don't mind giving our listeners a little bit of background into why you wrote Kent State and just whatever you want to share.
Sure. Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here today and really happy to talk about this topic of trauma in literature. I feel like I'm always writing about that when I look at my backlist and what I've written over the last 20 years. Somehow it's always about the way that we handle what comes to us that brings us great grief or loss, and how we come through it. And especially during this time we're living in right now, that feels really pertinent and apropos. So Kent State, which is the newest book, is for young adults and above. I think it's a good crossover into the adult market. And it pulls no punches in letting the reader know what happened on May 4th, 1970, when protesting students at Kent State University, they were protesting the the Vietnam War and President Nixon's invasion into Cambodia to widen that war. The National Guard was called onto campus, and in 4 days of protesting and escalation of those protests and the National Guard trying to quell them, it all erupted on Monday, May 4th, into the Guard shooting into unarmed teenagers in their schoolyard, killing 4 of them, wounding 9 more, and effectively ending the Vietnam War time, meaning that we began to turn as a country and to get out of this war. But we ended the 60s as well. And I remember it. I remember it so well because I was traumatized by it. I was 16 years old. It was actually 3 days before my 17th birthday. And I lived in Charleston, South Carolina, where my dad was stationed in the Air Force. He was flying planes over to Vietnam, loaded with supplies, and he was flying bodies, and bodies back. And it was traumatic for him as well. And I knew not to really bring this up at the dinner table, but on May 4th, 1970, it was a Monday. We were all in school, and we didn't know what had happened really until the end of the day. There was just buzzing from teachers. But the next day and on into the end of the school year, it's all we could talk about was, how does the government kill its citizens? How does the government just decide to turn on unarmed teenagers and shoot them for protesting, which became a First Amendment rights issue? And that's what we also explore in Kent State. But of course, I wouldn't have known the terminology for it then. I just knew that it was stunningly, horrifically awful and tragic. That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I, wow, I'm moved just by your description, and I've read the book. I was at Winter Institute, which seems like a lifetime ago, and I was at this, I was at the Scholastic event, and I have forgotten now who introduced the book, at that evening gathering. But the talk was, oh, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of Kent State. We were all like, oh, okay. And here's a YA book about it. We're really excited. And we were like, wait, what? And the talk that evening about it was so moving. And I grabbed it and I read it on the plane on the way home. And I took it into the, well, I texted Michael about it before I was even finished, I think. Yeah. And I said, you have to read this book when I'm done. It's hard to talk about what it is. Like, you say it's about Kent State, but it's so much more than that. It's, you're in the moment. You feel all the ways it's related to today. Mm-hmm. It's deeply moving. And I said, you have to read it, but I have to finish it first. And then I brought it in and we started passing it around the store because it was just, I think we were both like, it's so moving. And I was especially struck by what I assume are, for the most part, imagined conversations, but it feels so real. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that aspect.
Yes. Thank you for everything you just said. This is my hope for this book, that it gets into people's hands and as many hands as possible, especially as I see history repeating itself. Mm-hmm. And as we really are in a place where this story is timely and it's time for young people to know about it and to act, it's time for all of us to act. So let me tell you a little bit about how it came together. That's a good question. I had been writing 3 books of the 1960s for young readers for Scholastic. And my editor, David Levithan, and I had made up this thing called the documentary novel. Hmm. And it had never been done before. And we had 3 books, 62, Countdown, 64, Revolution, and 69, Anthem, which came out last fall. So that completed that arc of the 60s trilogy. And those books are large. They're 400 or 500 pages, but at least 100, maybe more pages, are scrapbook materials. There's different scrapbooks that are inserted, especially at the beginning, to give you context. Because I have noticed that young readers, when I'm in schools and working with kids, I notice that and I did too. History is a list of places and names and events. And we don't often understand that there are many other things happening at the same time. So for instance, in revolution in 1964 in Mississippi, which stands in for the civil rights movement in the 60s trilogy, at the same time that Black voters are being registered in Mississippi, the closed society, for this presidential election in 64, the Beatles have come to America in that same year, and Willie Mays was having a great year. And you won't know that if you don't have some context to show you. So the scrapbooks were part of that context. So they have primary source material. They have photographs and song lyrics and newspaper clippings and propaganda and advertisements and all kinds of stuff that lets you see the news of the day. So as I researched those three books over the 12-year period that it took to have them all published, I came up against Kent State over and over again. Because when you research the 60s, you get Kent State in there. And every time I'd see it, I'd say, I could never write about this. This is so horrible. Mm. And then I created a Pinterest board for it. I use Pinterest to document research. So lots and lots of teachers go to my Pinterest at Debbie Wiles, and they can any book I've written, you can find all kinds of resource material on it, primary source links, that kind of thing. So I just created a board because I kept coming up against it and I kept shoving stuff in there. And then eventually I got to Anthem, and the last scrapbook in Anthem has a still of May 4th, 1970 of Kent State and some information about what happened there. And I said to David, as we put that in there, I said, there's just no way I can't write about Kent State next. It's a natural progression from these 360s books. But I don't know how to tell that story. And so we bounced around ideas on the phone and in person. And at one point, both of us realized we had read Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders.
Yeah.
I remember he mentioned that night at the Scholastic event.
Did I mention it that night?
Either you did or David did. Someone did.
I probably did, because I use it as a way for, if you've read that book, and many people have, you'll understand that particular vehicle that he used of the disembodied voices trying to tell a story, trying to be heard, trying to communicate, also gives you, beyond their personal histories, which you gather, you also get a look at the history during the Civil War and even before that, because some of those disembodied voices lived long before. So I thought, this might work, because I already knew from going to Kent State and from the research I'd done online, I already knew that there were so many viewpoints to this story. How could I tell only one?
Right.
How could I say this is what, that's what happened to me in school on May 4th, 1970, is we would gather in those little cliques and say, hey, did you hear about those kids? Mm. But all we had was three television networks and a newspaper. So the idea of one medium telling the story wasn't enough for Kent State, because there are so many unanswered questions, there's so much debate, and there's so many different viewpoints. So we solved that idea of structure by looking at Lincoln and the Bardo once again, and me saying, I can use this. And then David asking me a pivotal question was, what about collective memory? You know, what would you do with that? Take all those viewpoints and let them all be heard. Because any moment in time, and especially traumatic moment in time, a tragedy, has so many different threads to it. And it only felt right to represent them all, not just to honor those who died and were wounded and there and affected by that day, but also to honor story and to honor history, and also to make a call toward today of, look, we're doing the same thing today where we don't listen to one another. So I created two townie, I called them townies, the people who lived in the town of Kent, two townies, two students, another student, a Black United student, a National Guard soldier, all of them able to tell this story in a conversation, back and forth, arguing the points. And the reason they feel real to you is that they all come from something I read in research, that I fashioned to tell this story, but they come from oral histories, they come from letters, they come from historical documents, they come from facts. And I've taken them a little from here, a little from there, and managed to make a novel out of this, of all of their voices. But they are true to things I read, saw, heard, or were told.
I think something, too, that makes it so... it encourages conversation. And I think that something that helps with that is that the reader is addressed a lot of the time and asks the reader to engage specifically. And I think that that goes a long way, especially with young readers. I mean, if we're talking about literature about trauma and literature about trauma that actually happened, the best way to get them to ask questions is to include them in the narrative itself. I mean, that part really struck me when I was reading it, was when suddenly it addressed me, the reader. It gave me chills all over my body. And I was wondering, when did you decide to address the reader directly?
That's a great question.
You don't have to know.
I do. I like thinking about this.
Yeah. I like hearing about it.
It came naturally, but I think it came out of frustration and anger and looking at where we are as a society today that just feels so divisive and so divided. And I'm old enough now to realize to remember when it wasn't so divided. I mean, you always have your differing opinions, but the idea that we just can't listen to one another right now without everybody screaming louder and louder and louder, and acknowledging differing points of view, but being able to think critically and being able to change an opinion or being able to include other opinions. It just became so frustrating to me that we're in this place right now that is so polarized. It's just so polarized. And so I thought, I want to address the people who are getting ready to vote. I want they're getting old enough now, just like those kids in Kent State. They were all ready to vote. They couldn't vote until they were 21 because we changed that law after Kent State. And you couldn't vote till you were 21. Now you can vote when you're 18. Well, I want you to know how important that vote is. And I want you to listen to what happens when we don't listen to one another. I want you to understand what happens when we squash First Amendment rights, to petition, to protest, to assemble. Those are all rights that we are given in the Constitution. And if we don't have them, and I'm talking about any side you want to look at, people begin to get fearful, they get anxious, they get violent, and there's got to be a better way. So reader, come here, let me tell you this story, was basically what I did. I immediately began to identify that reader who would pick up the book and say, "Hello, our young friend, come here. We want to tell you this story." And I tell that story to this young reader and any reader throughout.
Yeah. And I loved especially that you acknowledged the two voices who were said, "We shouldn't tell the story. We're not going to agree." And the other voice saying, "That's exactly why we should talk about it." And that aspect of it really touched me, because I feel like it's so true, and it's part of what's missing now, maybe. I don't, I'm not sure what about it struck me, but I was like, yeah, we kind of tend to shy away from these things that we don't agree about, but that's exactly why we need to talk about them.
I agree. And I feel like we've fallen into a trap of special interests and ways that we want things to be without really even understanding why. So Kent State was an attempt at saying, here's why, here's what happened. And also to put Kent State in the continuum of what I'm calling government overreach. A reviewer used that term reviewing Kent State, and I just loved it so much I've stolen it. So I just love the idea of putting Kent State, it's important to put Kent State into the continuum from the Boston Massacre to Wounded Knee to Kent State. And let's look forward to things like the Dakota Access Pipeline or separating families at our borders or any kind of event. that the government steps into and takes away a First Amendment right and begins to dictate what the reality really is. And this is a government of the people, by the people, for the people, with certain inalienable rights. So Kent State is a huge call to action. And that's specifically done at the end of this book in the elegy to those four students, that I want very much for students to look at this and say, not on my watch.
Hmm. Michael and I were talking just before this interview, and I was sharing with him, I'm in my 40s, and I remember being in high school, and a lot of my teachers, especially a couple of American history teachers that I had, you know, you would get through the end of World War II, you would talk a little bit about post-World War II, and then it was as if history stopped. It was like, and then there was Korea, Vietnam, the end. And I think a lot about, you know, and they talk about, oh, yes, when I was in college, everyone was being drafted. And I was, it reminded me quite a bit. My children came home from this school year in September, and they were really teaching 9/11 as a historical event. And my youngest mentioned that her teacher was in preschool on 9/11. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? And it just, it really drove home for me that the people who lived it, I mean, like, you know, I was in college during 9/11, and they brought home these things and they had to interview us. And it was so deeply upsetting for me. And I was like, oh my gosh, why is this a school assignment? And then I was like, oh, this is exactly why it needs to be a school assignment. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where I'm going with as a question here, but it was just more of an observation of, as educators and as booksellers, when we bring a book that has a historical context to kids who maybe weren't taught something as history, I don't know. It really opened, Kent State really opened up for me a door in reading other things and learning more about it. And it just introduced it to me in a way where it had previously just been more glossed over.
I'm really glad to hear that, because part of the purpose, or part of the reason behind the particular structure of this story, is that it was such a horrific event. And I wanted to present it to you because of that in the most quietly eloquent and elegant package possible. So you have those 60s trilogy books that are historical fiction, but that are full of primary source material. They're big. They're meant to be big. And then you come into Kent State, which is scantly over 100 pages with no visuals. And I know that you're going to be able to read this story and go online and find out more. And if you're mm-hmm. curious, and if you are adventurous and creative, whatever it may be, if you're curious, let's just leave it at that. If you're a curious mind, you're going to go down a rabbit hole with that. Yeah. And it'll lead to this story, that story, the other story. And that's what I want for you. That's what I want for the reader, is to open up. Like you were talking about having those lessons told in school, so much gets told outside of it. So open up your mind and let this feed your mind, and let this story offer you a way up and out of where we are right now. Because I think any trauma story, any story about a tragedy, any historical moment also offers hope on the other side of it. It really does. And sometimes it's really hard to see. And the hope in Kent State is to move beyond this divisiveness that we live in now and create almost a new America. You know, go back to those ideals that were founding this country and make them for everyone.
Mm. I'm just like, I'm just really moved by this conversation. And to Jill's point about her kids learning about 9/11 for the first time, when we were talking about that, I was thinking too about specifically about Kent State and how, you know, I was quite young when 9/11 happened, but I also remember learning about Kent State, but kind of at a cursory glance. And in my memory, it's immediately that photograph of a young girl looking over her friend's body who has been shot. And that's the main it. So then it kind of becomes almost like lore. And so it's, I think it's really, it is a difficult reality to bring the truth back. And I think that that's why I think Kent State is so important too, because I never really learned about Kent State as much as I did in reading this book. And I was wondering, because this is something of a traumatic story, what line did you feel like you had to walk, if you felt like you had to walk one? And then how did you decide which characters within the story were going to be more like truth-telling maybe, or more emotional, that sort of thing?
That's a great question too. Y'all are great at this. You don't know it yet, maybe, but you are. This is really great. No, I mean it. I want to answer that because it's a great question. First of all, I want to say their names: Allison Krauss, Jeff Miller, Sandy Scheuer, Bill Schroeder. Those were the students killed on that day. And I wanted to honor their memory. And in order to honor that memory, I knew that I couldn't speak as them. And I also knew that I couldn't speak really for them. But a way to speak about them and about this tragedy was to eulogize them in some form by telling the story of that time. So I very specifically, when I went to Kent State, I went several times. And once I went just to walk that territory, go into the May 4th Visitors Center, meet those folks there who connected me to other folks. They're marvelous there. I recommend going and going to that ground where those four students fell and nine others. I went to the vigil that's held every May 3rd. At midnight, we light candles and walk around the campus silently. And we come back into the parking lot where those students were shot. And there is a memorial to each of them in the places they were shot. And someone stands in each of the four places where students were killed with a lantern all night long. And they alternate every 30 minutes. And the next day at noon, there is a remembrance, a memorial service for them and for the students who were killed 11 days later at Jackson State in Mississippi, which is also included in Kent State. But in order to tell that story of those four students and all of us in that time in our history, I wanted to be able to break it down. And in the archive, I discovered there were 4 days of this. I had no idea because I was getting my news from a very limited source and I was a teenager as well. And so I wasn't delving deep into those limited sources. And as I went to Kent State and visited the Visitor Center and sat for days in the Special Collections Archive and had mountains upon mountains of primary source material to go through, I realized I would break this story into 4 days. Hmm. Nixon announced the invasion of Cambodia on April 30th. On May 1st particularly, started these huge, huge protests. And they were across the country. They weren't just at Kent State. But at Kent State, that was the only place the National Guard was called out for it. Governor Rhodes was running for election to the Senate, and there was a runoff race on Tuesday. And over this weekend, he was not going to have discord in his state, on his college campuses. And when the mayor of Kent called and said, send in somebody, he sent the National Guard. So they were on campus for 3 days. And so I divided this into 4 days. I divided it into those voices so that you could hear those voices I was discovering in research. And now I'm going to forget the question that you were asking me that felt so important for that one moment when I said, you're so good at this. So would you remind me? Because I'm not so good at this.
please, you're doing really well, don't worry. I think it was really just
I could just listen to you seriously talk about this book, I think, all afternoon.
I know
there was a specific structural question that I wanted to answer. What was that?
It was sort of about who was going to be more emotional, who's going to be more.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
I'm with you again. So, because I can get wrapped up in this too, because it was a very emotional thing to go and research.
Oh,
it was just, I stood in the I stood up when I came to this letter, and there were many of them I discovered later, but I picked up a letter that had been in a box of correspondence about Kent State, and it was from a townie, a woman who lived in the town of Kent during the shootings, who wrote, "You should have killed more of them."
Oh.
I stood up holding that letter. I couldn't believe I saw it. And
I have to say,
started digging,
Jill's
digging through the pile.
Jaw is like on the ground right now.
I don't know what to say about that.
No. Well, I just got teary and I just stood there. And the woman that was in the archive, you know, making sure we all behave ourselves, she came over to me and she said, "Are you okay?" I said, I just nodded, you know, and sat back down. But it was nuggets like this. And of course, that's included in the book. And there are nuggets like this throughout. I wanted to make sure that you had a guide, that this young reader had a guide through the story. So the very first voice you hear, that first student who sounds so much more like, you know, I'm calmer than the rest of you, he takes us through. And then there's a more raucous student, and then there's the Black student, Black United students, who each of these voices stands for a certain thread in the story. And they're delineated on the page by being written on different sides of the page with different fonts and different size typefaces. So they're, you quickly get to know who they are without them having a name and without them being gendered even. You don't know. You just hear them. When we did the audiobook for this, which is astonishing, and I recommend it so highly, we picked out voices. We had to decide, is this a male or a female voice? And Paul Gagne at Scholastic Audio and I went through listening to so many different voices. And then Paul gathered these people together at a table and in a recording studio in one day, they did this book. And it's talking about an emotional moment. And this will be out there soon for people to hear snippets of, even online. I knew as I listened to them too, that we had done good, we'd done right by these voices. And so you've got the students, I know that the story is weighted on their side because I want young people to identify with these students. But you also are going to hear quite a bit from, like, say, the National Guard, who's, we were young and, or we were rubber workers or we were farmers or plant and car workers. And, you know, we didn't want to be there. We had just been called out on a student or on a Teamsters strike in Akron. And we had been there 3 days sleeping in football fields and we had no intents. We hadn't had any sleep. And some of us were students at Kent State who were trying to avoid the draft. So you'll hear from them that we didn't want to be there. You'll hear from Black Students United who say, "You see a white man standing there with a rifle and you don't think it has bullets?" We knew better. And they were told to stay away by the bus, Black United Students, and they did. And so, and you've got white students saying, "Oh no, they're fake. They're blanks. They don't really have ammunition." So you just have many different sides of the story to be told, including the townies who were basically saying, "You ruined our town." And to this day, some of them think that.
I do want to ask too, like you had mentioned in comparison to the other work, it's much shorter. And it is very economically written. And I wanted to know, was that emotionally difficult? Like, did you feel the need to pull back and or want to do more?
Every book is different and every book has its different challenges and also its different pleasures. And with this particular book, I agonized over, once David and I had talked several times and I knew what my course was going to be with it because it felt right. And I had gone to Kent and I had mountains of material. I hardly knew where to begin. And I knew I was going to use these voices. I knew that in part three, I was going to eulogize the students and let you see them and know them for who they were. And in part four, I knew that I was going to get specific. So in part four, which is May 4th, I wanted to be as specific as possible because I've pulled you along through what happened, the different voices that are talking about what happened May 1st, what happened May 2nd when they burned down the ROTC building. Who did it? We don't know. We'll never know. Everybody has a different opinion as to who did that. But there was violence that night. There were kids who were bayoneted. But then we're building up and up. And then on May 3rd, which is Sunday, which is a much more quiet day, even the students were even going out to talk to guard soldiers and say, what are you doing? Why, you know, flowers are better than bullets, as Alison Krauss said. And then on May 4th, when things erupt once again and the shootings occur, I wanted you to know specifically how each of those four students died. I wanted you to hear it. I wanted you to see details. I wanted you to know exactly what it was like for them to be shot that way. And I then said to the reader, insert your name here. Mm-hmm. In other words, you could have been Allison. You could have been Jeff. You could have been Sandy. You might have been Bill, who were just walking to class. Sandy and Bill were going to class. They weren't even part of the protest. And then as we get to the elegy that ends the book, insert your name here takes on a whole different meaning. And basically it's, you know, you get to be, you get to make a choice now. What will you do with the future? And that was quite a ride to take from April 30th and what happened with Nixon invading Cambodia, and then those students erupting all the way to the very end with ambulances taking kids away, and me challenging that reader to take a look at what just happened. It took me through quite a journey.
Yeah.
But as I began to write it, it just came and came and came and came and came. It was very much like I wrote a book some years ago called Each Little Bird That Sings, and it was about a time in my own life that I had been through a tragedy, and a little girl named Comfort, I called her that because I needed so much comfort, was going to go through the same sort of loss. And that book, it didn't write itself, but it just kept coming. And it was that way with Kent State. Once I had done all of that seeded work and understood what the story was and how I wanted to tell it, those voices were right there with me. They were right there telling me what to say. And I knew it because I had inculcated all that information and all that research and all that drama and all those facts. They were all there. And then it was a conversation, and it wrote itself in a few months, actually, which, like a book like Countdown, book one of the 60s trilogy, took years, years, years.
Yeah.
It just depends, you know. They come as gifts. They come through you. These books, they're not me. You know, they come through me. And this one particularly, I knew it did. It just came and came. And my job was to capture it and to allow it and to help shape it.
Yeah, it's successful in so many ways. I mean, it's eloquent. It's moving. And, you know, just the refrain, this didn't have to happen. And by the end, I got all teary on the plane. The person next to me is like, are you okay? but it's just, you're just struck by the tragedy of it and the senselessness of it and the fact that it didn't have to happen.
I think that is so true, Jill, and that refrain, like the simplicity of that, I think magnifies the truth of it, you know, like those are like really hard but simple truths. This didn't have to happen.
Oh, I think so too. And this is one reason I wanted to address the young reader specifically and personally, because I want them to understand what happened. I want them to understand citizenship. I want them to see that facts matter and that everyone's story is important and that listening to those stories is vital and telling your story is just as crucial. And memory is malleable and opinion is emotional and thinking critically is really crucial. So I want them to understand citizenship, shape history, and vote. I want them to be the change they want to see.
I
can't say it anymore.
I know. That was so beautiful.
Oh, I do. And I know you do too. You know, this is what's so wonderful about independent bookstores want the same thing. You know, independent bookstores are not just bookstores. That's a good thing. But, you know, through those books, they're offering the world to readers. I mean, if I may just say a moment, I have been on this crusade in the last few months, especially trying to highlight independent bookstores in all my social media channels, and especially the ones who have ever had me on tour or who were going to be scheduled for this particular tour. And this is one reason it's such a pleasure to talk to you, because I understand independent bookstores as community gathering places and democracy holders and citizenship builders. And it's just, and also pretty fun places to be, you know, comfortable, fun, loving, yeah. But also really smart, smart places that we need. We want you to be there. And it's my hope that we get through this time, which is just as divisive in some ways as Kent mm-hmm. State was. But look at how we're pulling together in solidarity. So many of us staying home and supporting one another and cheering each other on and encouraging each other to keep going, keep going. We're going to keep going, right? We're going to keep going.
I have to say, I have noticed a lot of your social media interactions on even just our Instagram account.
Good.
And I love what you're saying, because, you know, Blue Manatee, what we do is, like, we're a literacy program. We really... Mm-hmm. We are those
yes.
community builders. And for every book that's purchased, we donate one to a child in need. And I think that hearing that from authors and creative people, I think is like helps get that message out even farther. And it's just, I mean, I know I speak for all of us when I say like we are beyond grateful for that.
Well, I'm grateful for you as well. And you can see Kent State, you know, coming through your bookstore to schools even, and in cross-curricular courses and into libraries, into homes, into drama departments,
yeah.
because this would be great for readers' theater or staged as a play. And it's written partly because I know it would be that way, and I know it would reach more people. But coming through you is the way to go. You know, I understand that. Coming through Blue Manatee and getting out there into the world, I mean, that's what we're doing, sitting here together with each other today in our separate socially distanced homes.
Safely.
But, you know, we're all three here, and yeah. it's important.
Yeah, it is. I'm speechless now.
Me too.
Well, unfortunately, I'm never speechless.
Frankly, Jill and I rarely are either.
No, you all are great, and the work that you do is vital, and it's a companion to the work. You know, people talk about who write literature for young people talk often about gatekeepers, and they say in order for us to reach our audience, we have to go through bookstores or teachers or librarians or parents, or there's just this massive like gatekeeper atmosphere that some people talk about. But I don't think it's gatekeepers. I think we look for partners. And mm-hmm. I think that's what we have in independent bookstores. We have partners who help us to get the word out. So I appreciate you, and I really am grateful for this opportunity today. Really.
I am eager to be a partner in getting Kent State out.
Oh, yeah.
It's, of course, we hope all of our listeners will buy it at bluemanatee.org.
Well, I will. You do not know how many of my books I have sent from independent booksellers this season. I have called my friends. So get ready for your call from me, because I've called my friends and I've said, okay, I'm sending my book too. And they'll
Amazing.
Say, really, your book? And I'll say, yes, my book.
I love it. I love it. Let's get it in everyone's
hands. We can't
hands.
Be out there right now. We can't be out
right.
there. So, you know, I want people to have it. And there's
yeah.
many people I owe this book to. So they'll have it.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Deborah. Deborah Wiles is the author of several highly acclaimed books, including the beloved Love, Ruby Lavender that we talked about a bit today, and two National Book Award finalists, Each Little Bird That Sings and Revolution. Her first picture book, Freedom Summer, received the Ezra Jack Keats New Writer Award. She is also an NAACP Book Award finalist, E.B. White Award winner, Golden Kite Award winner, Jane Addams Peace Award finalist, a recipient of the PEN Phyllis Reynolds Naylor Working Writer Fellowship. Her newest book is the YA novel we discussed today, Kent State. She lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and you can visit her on the web at deborahwiles.com. Follow her on Instagram at Deborah Wiles or on Twitter at DeborahWiles101.
Thank you so much, Deborah.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure and my honor.
So we did this interview yesterday, and I'm still rolling it around in my brain.
I honestly keep thinking about not just what she said, but how passionate she was about it.
Yes. Yes. And I felt that passion in the book when I was reading it. Yeah. And then when she was talking, I just wanted to be holding a little sign that says, I co-sign everything Deborah Wiles says.
And just from a creative perspective, it felt so organic that this would end up being a story that she felt like she needed to tell because of the work she was doing before led her to this.
Yeah.
And that kind of to the point that we were talking about earlier, things feeling like it's too soon, it's too soon, it's too soon. Well, it's been a while. I mean, as you said, this May is the 50th anniversary. And I think that though I don't necessarily think that that's the case always, that anything's ever too soon, that much time, I think, offers Deborah Wiles the room to be really honest in her writing about it. Because yeah. We aren't learning about it anymore. I mean, we as we spoke to her, I don't really remember taking that much time in school to discuss the Kent State shooting. And so the most I've ever learned about it was reading this book.
I don't remember ever talking about the Kent State shooting in an academic setting. I feel like I learned about it more from music and movies. I mean,
yeah.
This is going to sound terrible, but like Forrest Gump covered this more in depth than I felt like I learned about it at school. And as is so often the case, I feel like the music that came out of that movie and the movie itself led me to be more curious about some of the events that were not covered in school because we just didn't learn about that. We didn't talk about it. So I feel like I learned about the mid-60s to the mid-70s more
through media.
As an adult than anything else.
Well, and I want to ask you because, you know, it's in a year, it'll be 20 years since 9/11. And you had mentioned your kids coming home earlier in the year with a real emphasis on learning about 9/11. When that happened, did it feel like, because we remember that so well in a way that it kind of feels like it was just yesterday. Did that feel, was your initial response like, this is weird, it feels so soon?
Actually, I didn't realize it had been 20 years until 3 seconds ago when you said it. Yes. The kids, I think, had talked about 9/11 in the past a little bit. And this year, it felt like it was handled in the way that they handle Veterans Day and like Indigenous Peoples Day. Like they had a project to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to interview someone who had been alive during 9/11 and then kind of write up a first person, like a little report from the interview.
Mm-hmm.
And all four of our kids had to do this. And so it looked a little different based on how old everybody was. But when they brought the project home, it was upsetting to me. I think I came into work and talked about it. I was like, I don't know if people realize what they're asking for, because, you know, depending on what your experience was, this could be really horrible thing to talk about. And that was my initial reaction. I was like, no, this was a terrible day and I don't want to talk about it. To the point even where I think Mark did the project with the kids. Wow. I was like, I'm good.
Yeah.
Reflecting on it now, I'm like, no, this is really important and we really do need to teach it. And all the things that we talked about in this interview with Deborah really kind of, honestly, it's really what started to bring me around on it.
Sure.
Because we do need to teach it, and it is first-person narrative, and these experiences are so important in telling the story going forward. And I don't know if it was because it just blindsided me and I didn't see it coming.
Sure.
But my initial reaction to it was very strong and very swift and not in the camp of liking it. I was wrong.
I think we take for granted that we did live through it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that we forget because it's so part of our, I don't know how to say this. We experienced it. And so I think we forget that people didn't. And we take for granted.
It's part of our collective conscience.
That's literally a phrase I couldn't think of. And I think that's maybe the point that Deborah Wiles makes with Kent State is that she was 16 when Kent State happened, and the experience was like, we don't talk about it at the dinner table, but we're experiencing this thing, and now time has passed, and she through her research started to relive it, and I think that is so fascinating because there is sort of a responsibility on our part to do that. I think it is a responsibility to not forget. I mean, that sounds so patriotic. I don't mean that like never forget, you know, but I mean like we have to talk about them.
Yeah, no, I agree. I will say that this book and these conversations were kind of the beginning of changing my opinion on this entirely. And I'm so curious now. It makes me want to go back and talk to, you know, my parents and my in-laws. Mark's dad has always been really great about talking about the draft. And I'm not going to retell the story correctly, but basically he somehow... This is terrible. I should tell this story better. He somehow knew, or he had a feeling, I guess, that he was going to be drafted.
You've mentioned this to me before.
And he wanted to be in the Navy. And so he went and enlisted. And his being drafted papers arrived at his house while he was, I guess, at boot camp.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he talks about being on an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean, and he is the only person that I know that talks about the experience of living through Vietnam, but I've never had a conversation with my own parents, and it just makes me so curious now. Now I want all the first-person narratives. Yeah. I feel like this just kind of opened up. I want to know more about Kent State. I want to know more about the experiences of Vietnam and not just kind of the poster in your mind of what you think of for the 60s.
Absolutely. And isn't that interesting how those types of stories leave a real detailed image in your brain? Because my mom has told me she remembers sitting and watching the draft happen with her parents and my uncle and just hoping that my uncle was lucky. And the way she talks about it as like the blue screen of the television and sitting in the dark, their living room in the dark and watching the news is like one of the more powerful images my mom has ever given me, because I feel kind of like a ghost in the room. I feel like I'm there. Yeah. And I think, I don't know if that has to do with the experience, because that is also how I feel about 9/11 when I think about everything around 9/11.
And that is what Deborah was able to capture in Kent State. You feel like you're there.
Yes. And she does such a good job of being very intentional with that. I mean, she addresses the reader. And sometimes when I'm reading for quote unquote young adults, for the age group that it's for, I'm doing quotes here because books are for everyone, no matter what your age is. I try to think about teenage Michael or like how he would respond to this. But I didn't do that with this one. I just felt like adult Michael, like how I'm responding to this and in the way that it was impacting me. And you and I were talking about this back in February when we wanted to first interview Deborah Wiles, and we were saying how it really does remind me, reading it reminded me of the way adults started talking to me after 9/11. There was like some sort of change in how I was perceived by adults. And I think it was because it was a really quick and specific loss of innocence that all of us experienced. And I think that offered a little bit more reality with every conversation I had with adults.
Yeah, I was very struck by that. And the other thing I've been turning over in my head and thinking about since I first read this book back in February is how there's so much misinformation flying around in the 4 days, and you feel it, and you feel like it's currently happening. And you know, it's like, well, are there outsiders here? Have people been deployed purposely to make trouble? And you're kind of feeling the growing anxiety as it's happening in the book. And I was struck by that and kind of the misinformation parallels to present day and how we get so entrenched in our opinions that we can't hear other perspectives, and we lose the thread of digging down and distilling to what the shared facts are or what really is happening.
Yeah.
And how easily that happens and how we're experiencing it now.
Yeah, what did she say? Memory is malleable and opinion is emotional.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just like, oh, all the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, to parallel with what we're going through right now, it is very different in that two different types of traumatic events. One is a shock and a surprise, and this was a slow build over the course of a couple of days. I mean, it happened really quickly, but it was a... There was a little bit of a, this is coming and we have to deal with it. And the effects, though, are very similar. I mean, there's so much misinformation going around right now. And the book deals with that really well, with the traumatic event that is a shock to everybody. I mean, perspective is really interesting here, because the characters in the book talk about that a lot. I mean, there are some people who are like, you had to have known what was coming, versus you guys destroyed our town, versus like just real, like we were not trying to destroy your town. We were trying to make change. And just the way people react to trauma is, I think, one of the really powerful things about this book, because it is generational. And we something that we talked about a little bit in the opener, and something that Deborah Wiles mentioned, was that she was very intentional with not placing gender on any of the characters.
I could not decide how honest to be. When she said that, when we interviewed her, that was the moment I realized that had occurred in the book.
And it's been months.
I did not pick up on that on reading it. I had in my head assigned genders to everyone. Apparently, I thought I had read their genders, but clearly I had just made them up. And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And then when she talked about listening to all the voices, I have got to hear this audiobook now.
I cannot wait to hear the audiobook.
It's like I've been meaning for a while to make a Libro FM account, and this was the thing that got me going on that.
Good.
You can pre-order. Yes. I cannot wait to hear. And I'm so curious now which genders they decided on for the narration, because I definitely made some decisions
gendered
in
them.
My reading.
Yeah. And I think that says a lot. That it's such a layered decision, because it offers us a little bit of reflection, right? Mm-hmm. Because I put gender on these characters as well. And then upon realizing that they were genderless, made me realize how subconsciously I was gendering people based off of gender roles that, like, I hate
right?
them. And look what I did. I mean, like, the elderly couple, I knew which was the man and which was the woman.
Yes.
The angry one was the man.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that is neither right nor wrong. I mean, it's technically, it's wrong, because there wasn't a right. And I like being confronted with ways that I can be better. And that is one of them.
Yeah, I agree. I want to go back now having this piece of information. I'm eager to reread.
Me too. I really do want to. I read it so quickly and I actually am not into that. I like to spend time with books, especially when I'm loving them. I hate finishing a book that I love. Like, I love and hate it. But I like couldn't put this down. I mean, I read this over lunch one day and I was just like, I just absorbed it. So I agree. I really cannot wait to reread it.
Yeah, I read it on a flight and got through the whole thing. But then it just stuck with me in that way that I mean, we told her I brought it back and I had to talk to everybody about it and I needed other people to experience it.
And I'll back you up there. You did. You all of us talked about it. You weren't blowing smoke.
It was amazing.
And I'm also curious about our listeners. Like, this is not a unique conversation that Jill and I are having. You know, the wild thing about it is that anyone listening has an experience with a generational traumatic event, and it is a personal experience that they had. And I'm curious about when we ask that question, what's the first traumatic generational event that you can remember, what that is for you, and how in the years that followed it, did you engage with that? And what media did you absorb? And how did it feel? And did it help you? Did it hurt you? Did it feel exploitative? What was that for you?
Yeah, this just popped into my mind. We haven't pre-talked this.
Yeah.
You can call me crazy. Do you remember what's the movie about World War II with Matt Damon and Tom Hanks and
Saving Private Ryan?
Saving Private Ryan. Do you remember when Saving Private Ryan first came out and they were talking about the Greatest Generation and about how they came home? And the message was, great, you're back. That's over. Moving on. And then there were all these stories about how they sat in that movie and all of a sudden were processing.
I have chills.
All of the feelings about having come back from that. I am really curious to see if this book connects with people who lived through Kent State in ways like that. And I hope we get to hear those stories.
Yeah, I certainly hope we make room for them, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, this was an amazing interview. And I have really just loved talking about this book. Please go out and buy Kent State by Deborah Wiles. It's amazing. You won't be sorry. We hope you'll order it at bluevanity.org. We want to thank both Deborah Wiles and Scholastic for making our interview with Deborah possible. Deborah Wiles is the author of several highly acclaimed books, including Love, Ruby Lavender, and two National Book Award finalists, Each Little Bird That Sings and Revolution. You can visit her on her website, deborahwiles.com, follow her on Instagram at Deborah Wiles, or on Twitter at DeborahWiles101.
Thanks for listening.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast. If you're interested in learning more or donating to the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, you can find us online at bluevanity.org.
This podcast is produced and edited by Jamie Ryan.